Denise, you ought to be able to recognize them. I have the right names. I'm Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Don and Casey and Sharon and I were walking down the hall a while ago, and Denise was there with his ribbons in his hair. And so Don said, don't you think he looks good? And he said, it really does turn the women on. And I looked at him and I said, you know, it's kind of exciting me a little bit, come to think of it. Sure, he does that now. That's not what he said out there in the hall. Room 134, right? I really do appreciate being asked to speak. It's a real treat to be in an AA meeting. It's a special privilege to be able to talk. Born and raised in western Kentucky, and being down here in Arkansas is just not that much different. And we sound alike and we look alike, and I've been fortunate enough to travel all over the country, but we really do sound and look and talk a lot alike down here. So y'all think I'm just like y'all. You know, when I go somewhere else, they all wonder where I came from. You know? And the idea of a coon supper would be way out of line for them. They think it's something you raise out in the field somewhere, you know. Somebody down here a while ago told me, said, you ever eaten coon? I said, no. I said, well, it tastes a lot like dog. And I said, well, then I know what it tastes like. I'm looking forward to it. listening to Claire last night was I really enjoyed that. Because it solidified in my mind something that I've known for a long time. I have no problem with people doing about what they want to do. But I've watched a lot of people switch from AA over to Al-Anon, especially in that direction. And what I heard from that Al-Anon speaker last night, Claire, is that the programs are the same 12 steps finding a God of our understanding. And I felt real safe listening to her talk. And I remember when my son was in treatment, I'd been sober about 8 years, and they suggested I go to Al-Anon. Well, I went home and talked to a couple of good friends of mine who were in Al-Anon, and they told me they didn't have any problem with that. But they thought maybe I ought to look at my own AA program before I made that switch. That was real good advice. As I listened to her last night, I was really impressed with the journey to God. And really enjoyed it. I listened to Darla today. The thing that impressed me with Darla is the big book refers to the ravages of alcoholism in women. What medical science has discovered is that women are ravaged by alcohol much more quickly, much more severely than men. Now we have some medical information as to why that's true. But what I saw and what I appreciated was to watch those ravages be handled with dignity and poise and spirituality. And I appreciate that. Because there's some young women out there that feel that deep sense of shame. Now, the men come in, we come in with shame, and we come in with guilt. I've noticed men come in with more guilt than shame until we can scrape it away and get down to the shame. Women come in just racked with the shame, and someone needed to see that dealt with dignity. I needed to see it, but I know there's some young women out there, maybe some old women out there, that needed to see that, and I appreciate the dignity and the poise and the recovery. Don will talk tonight, and Don and I have been around each other for quite some time, and we talked at lunch today, and interesting enough, both of us from Louisville, and both of us share some real good friends, but we don't see that much of each other. And we talked today about the fact we missed that. But what I've come to know is that AA is kind of like a big tent to me, that we're all under there loving each other, and there are tent poles holding down the areas of that tent. And Don's over here holding down that side of the tent, and I don't have to worry about it. And I feel real good because I don't have to look around behind me and wonder who's holding that end of the tent down. And we'll cross paths more when God wants us to, and I'm just so grateful that Don's there because we do a lot together and never even see each other that much. Robert and Margaret. I would not want to leave Robert out. Most of y'all know Robert. And those of you who don't, well, you just been fortunate. That's all I can tell you. And I remember the first time that I ever met Robert and Margaret, we were at Autumn in the Ozarks. And I was talking with Robert, and Casey was talking with Margaret. And, of course, Robert has that bravado type of delivery. And after we got through talking, Casey came running over, and he started on her, boom, 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 just like that. And she said, looked at him, just sweet and innocent, "You must be Mr. Margaret." I want it, in case anyone ever listens to this tape all over the world, I want them to hear that. That's and if they don't, that's the way it is. My memory's slipping as I get older. It really does slip as I get older, and it just slips. That's all there is to it. And sometimes I just completely go blank when I'm giving a talk. And if I do, I'm setting up a deal here where I can get out of it, you know? And it's going to be a joke, but it tells a big story. And I used to forget things when I first came to the program, and I'll talk about that, and that's because of the booze and the wearing off of the booze effect. I'm getting forgetful now because of a lot of gray hair. And that's just the way it is. And it reminds me of this joke about this old priest, about 95 years old. And mine was still razor sharp, but he couldn't remember names. So he figured out a way to remember names. He wrote them down inside the lapel of his coat. So this particular night, he was at retirement dinner for one of his old proteges, a 75-year-old priest who had decided to retire. And this older priest was up there, and he sang, I have come to love my brother. This man that has meant so much to me over these years, this protege of mine who is the right hand of me in our pathway to God, my dear friend, Father James O'Reilly, who has been the parish priest and this favorite priest of mine for lo these many years, this parish of St. Michael, said, but most of all, I'm grateful for Father who has labored long and hard in the vineyards of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. So if I go, Jesus Christ, you know it's all over. Gone, I'm out of here. I was down in Beaumont, Texas, talking at a conference, and the man who was the voice of the conference is 85 years old, and he's been sober 45 years. And this man was incredible, because when he would talk, you felt like you ought to put a brainwave on him to see if he was alive. I mean, I'm very serious. You knew he had a flat brainwave, but his voice was, his lips were moving. You know, that's just the way it was. But if you listen to this man, he had an incredible sense of humor. And this is a joke, I promise you, you'll love it. This man had an incredible sense of humor. And he told a story that is the story of an alcoholic if I've ever heard it. And I want you to think about this. That this fellow used to be a circuit rider. He'd just circuit ride all around western Kentucky, wherever he was. He was talking about East Texas. He'd go to all these little towns, and he'd make his circuit about every month. And he was a roaring drunk. And when he would get to the motel, they knew that he was coming, and they'd have everything set up for him. And he'd do whatever he did there that night and go out and sell whatever he had to sell and come back in that night and register back in. So this one month he left this particular place, and he'd had all this fun he could tolerate. Remind me what you were talking about today about basically the story of the skunk, you know, the guy making love to the skunk. And he said, thank God you caught me. I've had all this fun I can tolerate. And that's kind of what this guy had. He had all that fun he could tolerate. So he went to AA. And as he made his circuit back around, he checked into this motel, and they had everything kind of set up for him like they normally did. And he went out to supper that night, and then they did their deal and had him all set up. And he came back in. He went to an AA meeting. They thought he was going out to get drunk like he always did. Well, as he walked in the room, he opened the door. They had him set up like they always did. There were these two beautiful women, nude, sitting on the bed. And beside the bed on the table was fifth whiskey. He sat there and looked at them a minute, and he said, you know, he said, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous now, and they've told me I got to change everything I'm doing. He said, so I can't drink that whiskey. And one of you girls is going to have to leave. Half measures availed us nothing, but we'll try them. By God, the hell freezes over, won't we? That's just the way it is. And we hear just what we want to hear, don't we? Just what we want to hear. I love it. That's an alcoholic story if I've ever heard one. Gave a talk in southern Indiana over in Jeffersonville. And I walked in at night to talk, and it's a birthday, and I normally don't go to that meeting. I know most of the people there, but as I walked in, one of the guys hollered back and said, "You're talking tonight." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, keep it honest and keep it short." And I said, "Well, I'm not sure I can do both." And he said, "Then keep it short." I got to tell you, going in, this won't particularly be short, but it will be honest. This is 22 years, actually it's more than that, it's 56 years of a whole bunch of reflections and the grace of God and all the journey that I've been on, and I'll try to keep it as honest and as concise as I possibly can. I will promise you that I will tell you my experience, strength, and hope, and I need to say, I'm not going to tell you it's the best way, the right way, or the only way to recover. It's what's happened in my life. Some of you are not where I am in recovery. Some of you are out in front of me. Some of you are behind me. Some of you are right where I am. Some of you will not be able to relate to what I say. Some of you, it'll ring your bell just like that. I would like to say that if there are any questions and someone wants to sit down and talk with me and ask me questions about my recovery or share with me their own, please feel free after I finish to buttonhole me, because that is part of the joy of my going to conferences, is to be able to sit and share with you maybe things I can't talk about now or just don't think about or just don't have time. And I'd love to hear what you got to say. But it's not the only way, the right way, or the best way. The big book tells me that my greatest asset or my greatest treasure is my experience. That's in the family afterward. And I will try to give you my experience. The one thing I've found, other than the fact that we're powerless over alcohol, that everybody drags into this program, without exception, disguised in many ways. It may be resentment. It may be fear. It may be shame. It may be guilt. But the common denominator is pain. An incredible amount of pain. I found only one power that is strong enough to deal with that kind of pain, certainly in me and what I see in others, and that's the power of love. When I was a little boy in Sunday school kindergarten in Western Kentucky in Mayfield, I would rock in that little swing, and I couldn't have been more than 3 years old, but I can remember them saying to me over and over, "God is love." When I came to you people and you talked about the third step and made the decision to turn my life and my will over to that care, what I felt was love. I could not process the concept of God. And I got to tell you something. In the first year, we know medically today that that's called abstract thinking. And you can sit there and beat your head against that wall and hell freezes over, and you're not going to be able to think in abstract terms. And a lot of times we will sit on people, or I used to, and they did with me, and say, "You are trying to define God. You are trying to say God is it." Well, a lot of times that's exactly what happened, and we can't do that. It just won't work. The brain is just that damaged. It has nothing to do with will. Has nothing to do with being bad. It has to do with exactly what happens from drinking. But what I could feel and what I could relate to and what made me feel safe was God is love. About 3 years ago, I became obsessed with the idea that maybe AA was in trouble. I became obsessed with the fact not only was it in trouble, God wanted me to straighten it out. It seemed like an insurmountable problem. Seemed just like an insurmountable problem. And I was talking to a guy out in Santa Fe who had been sober about 30 years who heard Bill Wilson right at the end of his life. Someone asked him the question, "How long will AA be here?" And he said, "As long as God wants it to be." And you cannot imagine how relieved I was to know I didn't have to straighten it all out about that time. But what I did ask a question was of a gal who's been sober now about 50 years, Geraldine D. from New Jersey. Been sober about 50 years, and I asked Geraldine back in about, 1987 or 88, I said, "Is AA different today than it was when you came in?" And instantly she said, "Yes." I said, "How?" And she said, "The difference is that when I came in, there were 20 old-timers for every newcomer. Today, there are 20 newcomers for every old-timer." And she said, "The principles remain the same, and what I think will have to happen is each of us will have to take on the job of, as best we can, exhibiting and teaching those principles, because we may not be able to lay hands on one-to-one. As much as we want to try, we're being inundated, thank God, and we're going to have to look at different ways in addition to that to carry the message." One of the things that I have done is make sure I'm always in at least one big book study all the time, a participant and a sharer. And many newcomers will come to that as we share this principle that is outlined so beautifully in our textbook. What I do know today is that the principles of AA are not changing, but the face of AA is. And God gave me a message about 4 months ago that just screamed at me as what's happening. You know the picture we see where the two guys are sitting beside the bed? They got their suits and coats on, and there's a guy sitting on the bed with his T-shirt on. And that's the picture we've seen of AA. That's the 12-step call. When I was down at Beaumont, I was a Saturday night speaker, and I got up at 7 that morning to do some meditation and spiritual work that I like to do on the day that I'm talking. Not a lot different from my everyday, but a little different. And I looked out to the pool, and around the pool down below me, there were two little girls. They were about 15. They were sitting at a table beside the pool, the only two people there. There's a table beside them. There's a big book and a meditation book sitting on that table. And they're opposite each other, holding each other's hands just like that. And you could see them with their eyes closed, and then they would turn holding hands, and they would read that book. And then they would turn back and hold hands with their eyes closed. The face of AA is changing. Two little girls, but the principles are the same. God loving us enough to give us each other. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous, and it will not change. It will be here as long as God wants it to be. I've found very few things that have not changed for me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first thing that I've found that has not changed for me is that I am constantly changing. I am constantly changing. People call this different plateaus of growth. I have no problem with that. What I can relate to are different plateaus of surrender. I have run my head into the wall over and over and over and over, and I keep standing back and looking. I'm talking about recovery. And I stand back and I look in the mirror, and the only nose that's bloodied is mine. And I keep wondering what the problem is. You know, I think if I hit the wall from a different angle, or if I take 5 or 6 more fourth steps and fifth steps, maybe it'll work a little bit better. It's trying to take that square peg, put it in that round hole, and the alcoholic solutions get a bigger hammer. That's the way we work all the time. Well, it's amazing how that is the 6th and 7th step, and the 11th step becomes more powerful in my life. I recognize that there have been different plateaus of surrender. And each of those plateaus of surrender involve when I do accept God's infinite power and my powerlessness, God's infinite manageability and the unmanageability of my life. And each time I have surrendered to that simple principle, He has screamed back at me through my sponsor and through you people, my responsibility. My responsibility. Burns, don't talk the program to death. Don't read the big book to me. Don't talk about the steps. Do them. It's wonderful not to be drinking. It is so good not to be drinking. Bill Wilson used to say that many times the good can be the enemy of the best. I have known the good from not drinking. I have known the best from working these 12 steps in my life and not just talking about it. Surrender to God's power, and my job, well outlined through the 12-step process. The second thing that has not changed in my life has been that I am powerless over alcohol. Alcohol whipped me. It left me nothing. It left me no dignity. It left me nothing. For 12 years, I took amphetamine. No alcohol. 12 years amphetamine. Amphetamine screwed up my life, and I'll go into more detail about it. I finally quit taking amphetamine in 1970. 12 years of amphetamine, but I didn't quit taking amphetamine because I was powerless over it. In my mind, I quit because it was screwing up my life. Then I drank alcohol for 8 years with no amphetamine, and I quit drinking alcohol because I was powerless over alcohol. Yeah, my life was screwed up. But that wasn't even the predominant thought in my mind. The predominant thought in my mind was, this has whipped my butt. No dignity. Nothing. No soul. No heart. Totally helpless. Totally hopeless. When I sit in meetings and listen to people say, I wonder if I'm powerless over alcohol, I think it'll take what it takes. But if you're an alcoholic of my type, I hope to God you don't have to pay any bigger price than right now. I hope you recognize that you're truly powerless. Finally, the last thing that's not changed in my life is that it will take a power greater than me to restore me to sanity. Now, it took a power greater than me to restore me to sanity from the insanity of drinking. But I'm talking about a power greater than me to restore me to sanity from the insanity of sobriety. I have made many and more dumb decisions sober than I've made drunk. You know? I mean, it's incredible. I practiced medicine for 25 years as a family practitioner. A year ago this past January, I retired to take over as chairman of the impaired physicians for the state of Kentucky, primarily to teach doctors. primarily to teach doctors how to treat us and how to get doctors into treatment, how to get them back and get them back treating patients into some sort of recovery and into AA and good aftercare. I will do that as long as God wants me to do it. I am returning to the partial treatment of practice of medicine because I miss it. But it'll be on a part-time basis, and that starts next week after being out for a year. But approximately 2 years ago, I was walking down the hall of my office, and I just had my belly full of me. Did you ever get your belly full of yourself? You know, I was just walking down the hall, and I was just fed up with me. And what had precipitated that event was my office manager didn't get a patient back on time. It took her 30 minutes to get the chart back. My nurse didn't take the blood pressure, didn't take the temperature, and put the patient in the room. So when I walked in 45 minutes late, the patient was on me like stink on feces. I mean, she tore me up. And I'm standing there, I'm taking it, but I'm thinking, oh good, I can't stand it. So I walked right out in the hall and did the only thing anybody could do under those circumstances, I fired both the girls. Fired both of them. And they walked on up to the front office, and I sat there, and I thought, God, I am just fed up. How long have I got to deal with this insatiable ego? Now, I'm not talking about that ego that wants to skydive naked at the Super Bowl, you know? And I got to tell you, there ain't one drunk in this room that wouldn't love to skydive naked at the Super Bowl. Those of us who are humble would wear a mask. But the guys would all like to believe that they would recognize us, you know? That's right. All of us are just alike. No, it wasn't that. It was that ego that says, my way or the highway. My way or the highway. You know? Over and over again. And I just had my belly full. And I did, what does it say in the 10 steps? Program simple, but not easy. Program simple, but not easy. What do we do? You know, each day we'll face self-centeredness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. What do? We ask God to remove it. We talk to somebody. We make our amends, and we help somebody. Boom, 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 boom. Incredibly simple and easy marching order. Walked into my office, got on my knees. I said, God, please take this away. Picked up the phone, called somebody in the program, talked about it. Went out and did exactly what I needed to do. I hired both the girls back. They were still there. I fired them 6 months before. They knew I was coming back. I always came back. Hired him back, made my appropriate amends, went to the meeting that night, and I got in the men's meeting on Tuesday night in my home group. Somebody said, anybody got a problem? I said, yeah, I got a problem. I said, what's that? And remember this 2 years ago, I said, well, how long have I got to deal with this insatiable ego? It's just eating my lunch. One guy's been sober about as long as, he's been sober 2 years, and the guy who's his sponsor is sitting here, and one of my dearest friends, and Jack was sitting there, and he raised his hand after a few people talking. He said, I don't know how long you got to deal with that insatiable ego, but you taught me just one day at a time. And I said, you know, you raise them and they just jump up and bite you right in the butt, don't they? Isn't that wonderful? You know, today's guru may not be able to pick his nose out threatening his brain in this program. That's just weird. When we say the Lord's Prayer, we'll all circle up and we'll hold hands. And it's a circle. There are no pyramids. And the people in this program like me who every now and then want to get the guru status, y'all just don't let us do that. You just don't let us do that. I found out in dealing with that insatiable ego on just for today, there are other things that I have to do. And it's beautifully outlined in the 10th step. We're not cured of our alcoholism. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. How am I going to establish that spiritual condition today? How am I going to establish that relationship with God, that functional relationship with God? Not getting impaled on the third step, not getting impaled on page 449, but actually executing all 12 of those steps. I have a sponsor. I have a home group. I have some pigeons. I try to be of service to God and my fellow man. I try to work the steps. I try to read the book. And I do have a God of my understanding as a result of these steps. I will tell you a couple of things I have learned. The first thing, in addition, when I say, God, please help me do the next right thing, I've learned to say, God, don't let me do anything to hurt me today. And don't let me do anything to hurt anybody else today. It's amazing what I have observed over these 56 years is that every time I hurt me, eventually I pay the price, but guess who pays the price first? You do. Mama, Daddy, first wife, present wife, my nurses, my partners, everybody gets blamed before I really scrape it away and get down to it. No, yeah, I pay the price, but dear God, don't let me do anything to hurt me or to hurt anybody else today. Alcoholism has been called a disease of perception. It says self-centeredness is our problem, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity, and self-seeking. Self-delusion and fear are incredibly perception-forming for me. I can take that exit sign, I can take that fan and change it into anything I want to change it into, to make it anything I want it to be, to allow me to do anything I want to do, anytime I want to do it. And I can do it sober just as quick as I did it when I was drinking. When I was drinking, it was to get a drink. Today, it's just absolutely to get my own will. Alcoholism has been called a disease of perception. I'm going to tell you a joke about perception. I tell you it's a joke because I've been telling this joke for 10 years. It's a great joke. I tell it beautifully, and it just tells everything about perception. I'm not an airline pilot, so give me a little bit of poetic license. Here's a pilot sitting at 10,000 feet. The ceiling's 100 feet off the ground. The pilot's flying along. He calls the tower, and the tower says, when you land that plane, if you come through that 100-foot ceiling, you better put that plane on that runway, and you better stop it right now because you only got one shot. He said, now, you don't have to. And he said, I can do it. And he said, well, you got to stop it. And he said, okay, I can stop it. So he comes down through that 100-foot ceiling, puts that plane on that runway, throws on the brakes, tires squeal, the smoke comes up off the tires, the nose of the plane comes right up over the edge of the runway and just shudders and then just settles down. Pilot's sitting there just sweating to beat heck. He turns around to the co-pilot and he said, I believe that's the shortest runway I've ever seen. Co-pilot's sitting there sweating, looks around, he said, yeah, but did you notice how wide it is? They had a common problem and a common solution, but a different perception. Now, my recovery was a difference in perception. Let me relate that to you. I was born and raised in Mayfield, a little town not too far from here, as you well know. Born in a home where there was no alcohol and there were no drugs. My grandfather died drinking lye water in the Mayfield City Jail. My mother was raised in that home where she was ravaged physically, emotionally, and sexually. They had an interesting way of treating alcoholics in Mayfield at that time. When they put my grandfather in jail, they would, when he sobered up, they'd put him in shackles and put him in a chain gang, and he would go out and sweep the Mayfield City streets. Mama would walk past her daddy at least once a week, watching him in a chain gang sweep the Mayfield City streets. The kind of rage and anger and fear and resentment and guilt and all the feelings that come with that really came home to me when my daughter, who is in AA, been in AA 11 years, came to me after 5 years and sat down with me to make her amends. As we began to talk, and the healing continues today, as we began to talk, she said, Daddy, she said, when you were drinking, you'd come in, you'd slap Mother, you'd come up and scream at us and make us go to bed. If we tried to get out of bed, you'd paddle us. And said, I hated your guts, and I'd pray God kill him. Just kill him. So the next night you'd come in, you wouldn't be drinking, you'd hug Mama, you'd come up and read us a story. If you got home early enough, you'd take us out to McDonald's, and I'd go to bed that night, and I'd say, God, I was wrong last night. Please don't kill him tonight. I love him. Said, I never knew whether I hated your guts or whether I loved you. And I began to know what my mama felt like with her daddy. She didn't know whether she loved him or hated him. When I was in treatment, I was supposed to be there 4 months. I came home at the end of 2 months, and I came home with the blessing of the people who ran the treatment center, with some rare exceptions. But when I got ready to leave, they said, you really shouldn't leave yet. And I said, why? And they said, well, you haven't dealt with your anger. And I said, you kissed my behind. Of course I've dealt with my anger, you know. Only it wasn't that clean a language. And they pulled me out. And he said, come here, I don't have time to play around. You come out here and get in this ring. And there were about 30 people in a circle. And he put me in a chair right opposite him. And he said, I'm going to ask you a series of questions. You answer these questions as fast as you can. So don't worry about the answer. Just answer them. First thing he said was, who do you hate most in this whole world? And I said, I hate my mother's guts. And through a whole series of questions that must have lasted no more than 30 seconds, but seemed like a week, I ended up on my knees, hugging his calves, screaming how much I loved my mother and how much I hated me. And he picked me up and kissed me on the cheek. And he said, now you know what the problem is. Go home and get an Alcoholics Anonymous, and you'll be okay. As I started away, he said, let me ask you to do something. He said, you will learn in the program how to deal with resentments better, but if you will carry with you a conscious thought to feel the other person's pain, it will make the journey easier to forgive. And for the first time, I felt my mama's pain. For the first time, I felt my mama's pain walking past her daddy in that chain gang
and being sexually molested in that home and never having anything to do to deal with it. Our home was dominated by an adult child, an alcoholic. I'm not getting into whether anybody believes it or not. You read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the family afterward, look at what it says. And in essence, it says you get raised around one of us or you live with one of us, you get goofy. And that's exactly what it means, you get goofy. And you can't deny that. You can shove it under a rug, but that's just what happened. Textbook says it. And Mama was a loving little lady, but she was goofy. And the way it came out in our home was conditional love. When I was perfect, Mama would talk to me. When I wasn't perfect, Mama didn't. So I solved that problem. I became perfect. And I mean, I did become perfect. If you'd seen the list of things I did in high school and college, you'd think that maybe one day I'd be president of the United States, but never an alcoholic. Never saw alcohol and drugs in the home. Alcohol and drugs did not affect me directly in high school and college. When I started medical school my freshman year, I walked in there, and I don't know about y'all, but I know what irritable, restless, discontented meant long before I took a drink or a drug. I felt wired from the first day I consciously heard a word. There's been a motor running in me, and that damn thing is just like that all the time. It comes out in many ways, but when I walked in that medical school, there were 100 of us in the class, and I looked around, and 99 of them looked like they ought to be doctors, and one didn't think he should be. Guess who that one was? They all looked like they ought to be doctors. I felt like I ought to be home under the bed. Under the bed. You know, that dean walked in and said, there are 100 of you in this class, only 75 of you graduate. I don't care if you got 100 A's, the last 25 will flunk. Look at the guy next to you, because he may not be here next year. I turned and looked at that sucker, and he's looking right back at me. I thought, oh my God, it's me, you know? All my life, I felt that motor running, 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 just like, get to A, get to B, get back to C, get back to A, get, what'd you miss at D? Go to A, go to E. You missed it, go back to C. And that's the way it's always felt, you know? Look at us in our meetings and watch us. You think, my God, what's the matter with that guy, you know? There's a professional meeting I go to on Monday night, and there's doctors there, and nurses, and pharmacists. And I walked in the other night, and here's a thoracic specialist. I'd let him operate on me in a heartbeat. Man is absolutely one of the best surgeons in the city of Louisville. And when I walked in the meeting, I sat down. He said, if I had a gun, I'd have shot that SOB. And I said, well, what the hell did he do? And he said, he honked his horn behind me at the red light. Everybody in the room said, well, hell, I'd have shot him too if I'd had a gun. That's us, you know. Woo, 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 just like that. And we're wonderful together. That's just the way it is. But that's the way I've always been. So I just started packing up all my clothes to go home. I thought it was over. Game was over. Might as well get out. I can't do this. They're going to be doctors. I don't know what I'll be, but I'm going home. As I started out the door, a good friend of mine came up. I couldn't sleep, couldn't study, couldn't do anything. It lasted about a week. A good friend of mine came up and gave me a capsule of amphetamine. I took that amphetamine. The motor stopped. The motor stopped. I have found four things that stopped my motor. Amphetamine, alcohol, sex, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know they haven't put me in jail one time for being in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But they put me in jail or did some severe bad stuff to me for every one of those other things, I'm here to tell you. But it stopped the motor. And what are we all looking for? Stop the motor. First semester of my freshman year, I was number one in my class. Second semester, I was number 100. Amphetamine owned me from the beginning. 2 weeks before graduation in 1962, I was kicked out of medical school. In an amphetamine rage, I beat up one of my medicine professors. They took me to the head of the Department of Psychiatry. Dr. Keller looked at me and he said, Burns, what's wrong with you? And I said, I take too many drugs. He said, do you believe that? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, we can help you. And I said, what are you going to do? And he said, we're going to put you in intensive psychiatric therapy. Their perception was, he said, if you can figure out why you take that drug, you can quit. You're going to think yourself into a way of acting. It's called cognitive thinking, cause and effect thinking, consequences of action thinking. It's the thing that keeps us from praying and stepping out in front of a bus and hoping that God won't let it run over us. We know better. The bus is going to run over us every time. God's going to say, don't step out in front of the bus. That's called cognitive thinking. Works beautifully for daily living. And it will eventually work in the program of recovery. Early on, it is the worst enemy I had with my brain. Gonna think yourself into a way of acting. Now let me tell you, I'm not anti-psychiatry, neither is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Some of the major contributions to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous came from psychiatrists, Harry T. Bolt and Carl Jung. If you study the history of AA, you know Harry T. Bolt had a major impact on Bill Wilson. I am anti-ignorance, and that's why I've dedicated my life at this time to helping physicians learn about our disease. It's why, walking on this side of the fence with you people, I've also been given a double-level role that I really accept gladly, and that is to tell people in AA there are a lot of us practicing medicine without a license, and that needs to stop. We're hurting people. And God knows we came in here wanting to help people and be helped. Wanting to help people and be helped. Not anti-psychiatry. Psychiatry taught me a lot. They didn't keep me from taking dope, but they taught me a lot. They taught me how to identify a feeling. And when I came to you people, I was able to truly identify the feelings that you put in a four-step. They led me through a four-step, basically. But when I came to you people, you carried it through the rest of the steps to a spiritual solution. And that gave me the peace. What does the book tell us? We come together for a shared common experience. We stay together for a shared common solution. And you led me to the spiritual solution. The psychiatry helped me. After 1 year, they looked at me and said, "How do you feel?" And I said, "I'm scared to death." "Well, we're going to let you back in school. Why should you be scared?" "Well, they're going to be watching me." "Well, why are they watching you?" "Because I whipped one of them." "Well, should they be watching you?" "Yes, they should be watching you." Should you be afraid? "Yes, I should be afraid." "Well, so that's great. It's a realistic feeling. Now you can own the feeling. The feeling won't have to own you." Made sense, didn't it? I walked back in there, and within less than an hour, I was strung out on amphetamine again and just sat and cried because I didn't know why. My classmates enabled me. They would take me home. I was married and had one small child. My wife would put me to bed. She'd call the medical school and tell them I had the flu. They knew better, but they didn't know what to do with me. I graduated in 1964. I was in Our Lady of Peace, the mental hospital there, between 64 and 67, four times, strapped down, IV fluid, straight jackets, padded cell. I might stay off 6 weeks, 6 months, 6 hours, but I always went back to amphetamine. It always put me in a mental hospital. 1967, I joined the Army, obviously to get away from Louisville. I was a doctor. They gave me the key to the pharmacy, the only key to the pharmacy. That's like putting a fox in a chicken house. The delusion was so great that I knew I couldn't take a capsule. They'd figure that out, so I'd take two beads at a time out of the capsule. It takes 1 week to empty that capsule, two beads at a time. You still got an empty capsule. You got to do something with the damn thing, and there I was. I've had a lot of people I've worked with who finally, especially physicians, when the board of licensure looks at them and say, "You got to recover, we're going to put you in jail and take your license." And they come to us and say, "I'm going to do the right thing now. I know that I'm going to quit taking dope and drinking whiskey. I'm going to do the right thing." Well, I started to do the right thing the first year after I was in the Army. When the general, the post commander, walked in, looked at me and said, "Burns?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Are you taking the amphetamine?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "If you don't quit, you're going to Leavenworth." And I said, I think I'll do the right thing. You know, so I did the right thing. I quit. Motive sucked, but I quit. I came home in 69, got back on amphetamine, had a gallbladder attack secondary to it. A good friend of mine came and said, "Burns, please quit." And I quit, 1970. Notice I haven't talked about drinking because I didn't drink. Not that much. Wasn't an issue. Then I started drinking. For 4 years, I drank. Might get drunk, might stay sober. Didn't set out to get drunk. Didn't set out to stay sober. Didn't set out to go to football games and see how much I could drink and make it home. Didn't set out to pick friends who only drank. Didn't set out to go to restaurants that only served alcohol. It was not a problem. The next 3 years I drank alcoholically. If you didn't drink, we didn't run together. Restaurants didn't serve alcohol, I didn't go. I knew exactly how much I could drink and make it through a UK football game or basketball game. I knew exactly how much I could drink and get out of the parking lot. And then it turned on me, and I didn't know. But last year I drank addictively, and I drank a quart of whiskey a night. But I told myself I wasn't an alcoholic because I never drank in my office. And I could believe it. When I came to you people, what I had to be honest about was the last month of my drinking, my office hours consisted of 15 minutes a day. 5 minutes to get there, 5 minutes to read the mail, and 5 minutes to get home because I was withdrawing the whole time. Somewhere between Thanksgiving and December of 1977, December the 1st of 1977, Casey and I were living together, and Casey is my wife, somebody I love very dearly, and usually at this point in time, because I really want to, I'd like to introduce you to my wife. Casey? I want you to remember what I'm telling you right now. I love this woman as dearly as I love anything in this world. She meant as much to me as any other single individual in my recovery. And right now we are having to go into some therapy, or wishing to go into some therapy to improve our communications because of the ravages of my own self-centeredness.
I don't love her any less today than I loved her then. The self-centeredness is there constantly. If there is the seminal definition of alcoholism, it's here, and it's self-centeredness. And the delusion that that can lead me into. She'd gone to work that day, and I'd tried everything that I could think of to quit drinking. I'd gone, scotch and water was my drink of choice. I'd gone to martinis. I drank 24 martinis one day and couldn't get drunk. The next day, I drank a bottle of beer and got drunk. I went to wine. I did everything, but I always went back to scotch and water. And I was sitting in the living room. She'd gone to work, and I looked out the window, and I knew it was over. I had to quit. Didn't know how to quit. I thought, I'll smoke dope. And I thought, who in the hell are you kidding? You know, you took amphetamine for 12 years, it just ripped you. You drank whiskey for 8 years, and it ripped you. For reasons you don't understand, no mood-altering drug will work in you. And frankly, if you're an alcoholic of my type, it won't work in you either. And it just ripped me. And I thought, well, then I can't live. I'll just do nothing. I thought, you can't live in that world without something in you. And I became totally helpless and totally hopeless. Couldn't live with it. Couldn't live without it. I said, God, please help me. And it dawned on me what to do. And I walked back into the bedroom, and I have no doubt God led me there. I don't understand all this. As Robert said, there's this one speaker that goes around, he said, everybody's doing what they ought to be doing. Everybody's just seeming to be happy. The world's floating along like it ought to be floating along. And I'm standing there, all I can think is, I just don't understand. You know, that's the way it is. And I don't understand all this stuff. But what I know is that I went back in that room, and I have no doubt that it took what it took, and that God led me back there to make a decision. I loaded my shotgun and put it in my mouth. I was not afraid of dying. I welcomed dying. I absolutely welcomed dying. It would stop it. I was scared to death of living. I became aware of a burning desire to live, and I literally crawled to the phone, called a good friend of mine who's a psychiatrist, said, David, please help me. I went to his office. He said, Burns, you've got to go in the hospital. I looked at Our Lady of Peace, and I said, David, I don't want to go back in that hospital. It never helps. But then I said, the beginning surrender to what was going to be the cornerstone of continued recovery on a daily basis. I said, I will do anything you tell me to do. I quit bitching. I quit manipulating. I quit arguing. I quit negotiating. I surrendered and said, please tell me what to do. He sent me to a psychiatric hospital in New York because all I would talk about other than the fact that I drank a quart of whiskey a night was my depression. He said, Burns, you think it's due to the drinking? I said, I don't know, David, I'm depressed. Well, maybe if you didn't drink. David, I'm depressed. Well, Burns, if you didn't drink. David, I just pulled a shotgun out of my mouth. I'm depressed. Well, 100% of us who come in this program are depressed. Only 3 to 10% of us will need medication for it. Most of us don't know who those 3 to 10% are. Even in the best hands, it's a difficult call sometimes. But only 3 to 10% of us will need medication. 100% of us are depressed when we walk in this program. He sent me to a psych hospital in New York. My roommate hanged himself. A whole series of atrocities occurred after about 2 weeks. And I called him. I said, David, I'm an alcoholic. He said, are you sure? And I said, I've never been more sure in my whole life. And I mean, I was sure. Now don't get me wrong. I mean, I really wasn't running. I knew I was an alcoholic because I had to look at the differences in me and the differences in them and the similarities in me and the similarities in y'all. And that's before I ever knew you, but I said, I'm an alcoholic. So they transferred me to an alcohol treatment center in Atlanta. I was there for a month, went to the halfway house for 2 months and came home to y'all. When I walked into y'all, I came in, I said, what have I got to do to stay sober and be happy? You said you'd do anything we tell you to do. You're going to act yourself into a way of thinking. The profundity of this program is incredible. The profundity of this program boggles my mind as I get deeper and deeper into it, because they knew then intuitively that we were playing with sawdust for brains for at least 2 years. And that's what we've come to know. That's exactly what we've come to know. No way to think ourselves into a way of acting. Act ourselves into a way of thinking. I said, what have I got to do? You said, don't drink, go to meetings, and read the big book. Now, this is my experience. That's what you told me. Don't drink, go to meetings, and read the big book. Never changes. Real simple. You know, I don't know about the rest of you, but I can take a plate of spaghetti and in 5 minutes screw it up worse than it started, you know? That's just the way it is. It has to be simple. I'd sit down and think, don't drink. They just beat the hell out of that. They keep talking about, don't drink, don't drink, don't drink. Why do they just keep talking that to death? I know that. Don't drink. And then I picked up a tape of Sandy Beach's, stuck it in and started playing. He said, every time he got drunk, it was a direct result of drinking. And I remember standing thinking, this man's a genius. He's got the whole damn thing figured out, you know? No question, that's it. No, I thought it was my ex-wife, the medical community. But if you don't want to get drunk, don't drink. Okay, that's good. Don't drink. Don't drink. All right, don't drink. Now, go to meetings. So, okay, I'll go to meetings. Now, I'm going to reflect for y'all, 15 years now going to meetings. Let me take you back to that home in Western Kentucky. When I was a junior in high school, I came in one night after a football game, and I'd had one beer. And I normally didn't drink that much at all, but I'd had one beer. I sat down and threw up in the living room. Daddy came out and looked at me, and he said, Burns Mac, you've been drinking. I said, yes, sir, I had one beer. And he talked to me, and he said, you're not drunk. And I said, no, sir, I'm telling you the truth. He said, well, go on upstairs. We'll talk about it in the morning. Well, as I started up the stairs, Mom and Daddy's bedroom was right here. Now, you got to remember that little lady I described to you who was ravaged by alcoholism. And I'm her number one son. I am the hope of the Brady family. Her whole energy is invested in me. That's the way it was. As I started up those stairs, she came running out of that bedroom, grabbed me by the hair of the head, and she said, I'll never talk to you again, you little bastard. Wop, 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 wop. It took me 8 years of psychiatric therapy and 4 or 5 fourth and fifth steps to ever even remember what I thought. And I wouldn't have said it in that home I was raised in. And to this day, I'm grateful I was raised in a home where there was discipline, whether it was appropriate or not. There was an appreciation for dignity, an appreciation for authority, and my parents. And they did deserve it. But what I thought was, and you bitch, I'll never trust you again. And when I walked into this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't trust a one of you either. I'd been the deacon in 5 churches, and I'd been 8 years of psychiatric therapy, and if you didn't have the answer, I was dead meat. But I didn't trust a one of you. And what I found out in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous is it's a perfect program, composed of an awful lot of sick people in varying degrees of recovery, and some of us you can't trust. When I took my first fifth step, they ought to have had it on the front page of the local newspaper the next morning, because by God, that's where it was. Almost in intricate, vivid detail. When we came in the program, my wife, as you see, is a very attractive young lady. There were people who wanted to take my wife to bed. And I did vaguely understand that. But there were people who wanted to take me to bed, and I didn't understand that at all. I had no self-esteem, no self-confidence, pale as a ghost, little bitty arms, little bitty legs, great big pot belly, and little spider nevi all over my body. Whiskey had whipped my butt physically. Didn't make any difference. They still wouldn't take me to bed. Most of them were men. Some of them were not. I mean, most of them were women. Some of them were not, you know, but they wanted to take me to bed. There were people who wanted to borrow money, and they did. Didn't intend to pay it back, and they didn't. And I didn't know who had on the white hats and who had on the black hats, but I knew this had better be home or I was dead meat. Then I began to ask the people who would take me out to have coffee, why do you want to take me to have coffee? And the winners would say, because we want to stay sober and we want to help you stay sober. And I began to get the message and I began to trust. For the first time in years, I began to trust. And I had to trust. And trust is a 100% issue for everybody walking in this program. If for no other reason, just self-esteem and self-confidence. We just beat the hell out of ourselves. And there's nothing there to trust. We don't trust us. We sure as hell aren't going to trust each other. It has to come. And it will come gradually. That's why this program doesn't come overnight. Not for me, not for anybody. Not for anybody. Second thing about meetings, I found out that them that don't go to meetings don't hear what happens to them that don't go to meetings. Jim W. from Dallas, one time we were talking at a conference together, and he said when he first came in the program, his sponsor would come get him every night, take him to meetings. He said he'd hide. He said his sponsor would find him. He said he'd hide. His sponsor would find him. He said one night I hid so well, he couldn't find me. He said next day he called me and said, well, Jim, you missed it last night. And he said, what was it? He said, well, you didn't hear what you were supposed to hear. He said, well, what was it? He said, well, I don't know. I heard what I was supposed to hear, but you'll never know what you're supposed to hear. I've never walked out of a meeting that I didn't hear what I was supposed to hear. Most of the time, I feel better. But there are times I walk out of meetings, and there are 2 people in this room, 3 people in this room, know I've walked out of meetings where I was so pissed I couldn't even walk, talk, and chew gum simultaneously. And the message is, there's a chapter in that book that tells you to deal with resentments, and you better deal with it. I've never walked out of a meeting that I didn't hear or feel what I was supposed to hear and what I was supposed to feel. 8.5 years in this program, I was driven to my knees. I'd lived 8.5 years in this program with a 4-step program, the first 3 steps and the 12th step. 8.5 years in this program, I was driven to my knees to take our textbook and begin to study it. What I found in there are some interesting, wonderful, beautiful, powerful things. One of the things I found is that there will come a day when we will be unable to bring into our conscious memory with sufficient force the humiliation of our last dream. When I travel the country putting up these formulas for doctors that are doing nothing more than just elaborating on what Dr. Silkworth said, we have a physical allergy and mental obsession, the doctors will look at that and they'll say, "That's alcoholism?" I say, "Yep." "Well, why do you people ever drink again?" "Because we forgot what happened to us the last time we took a drink." "Oh, it can't be that simple. Listen in AA meetings. We believe the same thing. It can't be that simple. Y'all taught me early on, the further I am away from my last drink, the closer I am to my next one, if I don't remember what I am. Every time I walk in that back room or in that door coming into this room, I am reminded of what I am. Through the grace of God, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book and the 12 steps, you have helped me define for me who I am. The day I forget what I am, I will lose who I am, and you can take it to the bank. I've climbed over the bodies of people who have bled, and I am deeply sorry they bled, but I learned." Almost every one of them either said, they said one or two things. Either they quit going to meetings, they cut back on their meetings, or they just didn't work the steps. And usually it's a combination of both. We will forget. We've been taught that. And we see it over and over. We just will forget. Now, there are all kinds of medical reasons why we have selective memory. But I will promise you, Wilson knew when he wrote this book, he had seen it enough to know we just forget. That simple. I go to a lot of meetings today because this is where my friends are. This is home. I wouldn't choose to be anywhere else. And finally, I go to a lot of meetings today because I don't want to miss the miracle. I do not want to miss the miracle. I have had it in my life, but I really did not see it. Only today have I reached a point where I can almost feel the miracle turning in me. But for years, I have watched the miracle turn in you. And I've reached a point where I don't want to miss the miracle. And when I'm in meetings, I see the miracle over and over and over and over. And I don't want to miss it. It is an incredible joy and gift to see the miracle. And if I'm not in meetings, I miss so many of them. "Don't drink, go to meetings, read the big book." I said, "Okay, I can not drink, go to meetings, I'll read the big book." I got the big book down, I started reading it, and I thought, "That's beautiful." I closed it, couldn't remember it. I'd pick it up and start reading it again, and I'd close it and couldn't remember it. I'd pick up the Courage Journal and read it and close it and couldn't remember it. Pick up my meditation book and close it. I'd come into a meeting, I'd say, "I can't remember anything." You'd say, "Hell, don't worry about it, none of us can." I said, "How long is this going to last?" "About 6 months, 2 years. It gets better." "Yeah, it always gets better." I come in the next night and I'd say, "I can't remember anything because I forgot what you told me the night before, you know." I used to lose my car drinking all the time. I lost my car for the first year sober. I'd drive my car to the office, go in, practice medicine, come out and drive it home. One day I drove Casey's car, parked it, went in, practiced medicine, came out, looked around, and I started crying. I cried a lot the first 6 months of my recovery. Went in, got my partner, and I said, "Somebody stole my car." He went out and looked, and he said, "Burns, you drove Casey's car." And I said, "Oh, that's right, I forgot." So they figured out what to do. They assigned me a parking space. And they said, "When Burns leaves the office, he's going to that parking space. If he get whatever's in it started, he's going to drive it home." I came home, went into AA, went to church, went to a psychiatrist. They gave me a psychiatrist, said no alcoholism. I'd go in and sit with him on Tuesday, and we'd just rip my relationship with my mama apart. "Did you lust after your mother?" "Well, I might have. I don't remember." "Well, did you lust after your brother?" "I don't think so." "Did you lust after his tractor?" "Yeah, I lust after his tractor." And I'd leave on Tuesday, you know, and I'd come back on Thursday and say, "Let's pick up where we were on Tuesday." And I'd think, "Oh, God, I don't remember where we were on Tuesday." He'd say, "You're blocking your therapy." And I'd go, "I'm a worm. I'm blocking my therapy, you know." I'd go into the meeting and I'd say, "I think I'm blocking my therapy. I couldn't remember where I was with Homer on Tuesday." And they'd say, "Hell, you're lucky you remember where his office was when you went back there." The message is real clear. There's nothing wrong with therapy. Just be sure you go to a therapist that knows alcoholism. You can't feed steak to people who can't eat mashed potatoes. And it's just that simple. When I go to a therapist, I go to one who's in recovery. It isn't necessary for you to do it, but it is for me because they have to know a 12-step solution. That's the only way I know how to solve problems. is a 12-step solution. Has to be. Claire said it last night, very vividly. Has to be a 12-step solution. That's for me. Works real well.
Okay, don't drink, go to meetings and read the big book. Oh, I can't read the big book. Oh, my God, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I can't read the big book. I wonder how it works. God, please tell me how it works. I remember we read every night how it works. See, I was getting better. I was remembering how it worked. So I get that sucker down, and I start reading it. It says how it works. And the first paragraph, honesty, 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 three times. Boom, boom, boom. Those who don't recover are those who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are those of us who may have grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of us do recover. We have the capacity to be honest. The whole emphasis was honesty. I began, my credo became, don't drink, go to meetings, don't tell lies. When I went into treatment, and you've heard my story, I begged to go into treatment. I sat in the front of that guy, I was drinking a quart of whiskey a night that ran the treatment center. He looked at me and said, how much do you drink? I said, I drink a 6-pack of beer every night. He said, you're lying. I said, I know it, I do it all the time. Why'd I do that? I'd play golf, and I'd hit my ball up on the green. I'd go up there, and I'd put a dime in front of the ball to spot the dime, to spot the ball. I'd come back, and I'd put my ball in front of the dime. Just save myself a fourth of an inch on a 40-foot putt, and I just hated my gut. But I'd do it over and over and over. That summer after I came back from treatment, I'd hit that ball on the green, and I'd walk up there, and I'd put that ball down, and I'd put that dime in front of it, and I'd put that ball back down behind that dime, and I felt good about me. I began to feel good about me in all my affairs, right? And I remember walking down the fairway with my sponsor. I said, this honesty stuff is good stuff. It's good stuff. You know, they said Burns Brady will tell you the truth about anything. It may not have anything to do with what you're talking about, but he'll tell you the truth about anything. And that's exactly the way I began to recover. Don't drink, go to meetings, and don't tell lies. People have said that's cash register honesty. You bet your life is cash register honesty, and it's as important, it's as significant to me today as it was then. It's even more important because the delusion of this disease is even more subtle as I've had longer periods of times of sobriety. I have to be honest. Cash register honest. We're only as sick as our secrets. The book says we got to be honest with somebody. And I have to be honest. And when I stretch that beyond its limits, I know it. It eats my guts. And it's so subtle. There's one man in this room who knows it. Knows it as well as anybody. And you stretch that honesty, by God, the price isn't worth it. But we'll do it. We'll do it. And the only way I found is to stick that sucker in one day and be honest today. Be honest today. Don't run lab tests just because you can defend them to the insurance company. Run lab tests because the patient needs them. Don't make that telephone call for that clandestine affair. Because, sure, you've been sober 14 years. Can you get by with 11 steps or you got to have 12? You take your inventory. But let me tell you, if you're not honest with yourself at a level where you know you're honest, you'll get gutted. When you get gutted enough, you'll look for relief. You need anybody that's not insane or stupid. And there's no more stupid and no more insane in this program than there is in the normal population, let me tell you. And it will gut us. It gutted me. I didn't have to get drunk. I just got nuts. Somebody says, well, we got to be honest with ourselves. Well, I agree we got to be honest with ourselves. But you know one of the most powerful lines in the big books in the 10th step? Alcohol is subtle. Alcohol is subtle. Clancy tells it beautifully. Clancy says, I'm at 10,000 feet with God, and we're looking down at the AA program. And I said, God, how are they doing? He said, I've been sober for 20 years. And he said, God says, Clancy, they're doing great. And I said, God, how am I doing? He said, Clancy, you're doing great. I bet you could have a light beer. 1 year, 2 years in the program, a beautiful little gal, and I tell you, beautiful young women, I don't know that they're the scourge of mankind, but they certainly do. You know, somebody said, you know, I had somebody the other day said, you know, that looks like a woman, but it tastes like alcohol. And I'm here to tell you, the men are going, you know. I mean, it's there. It's there. I love women. Women are wonderful. They're God's, one of God's greatest gifts. But boy, are they, I know the siren song. 2 years in the program, beautiful black-eyed little gal came up to me and said, I'm having my first birthday. I want you to speak at my first birthday. And I said, where are you going to have it? And she said, St. Thomas. And that's a very powerful discussion meeting, my home group at that time. I said, well, let me go home and pray about it. And I went home. I got on my knees. I said, God, please let me know what I should do for Patty. It's her birthday. What do you want us to do about the Tuesday night meeting? And all of a sudden, I felt it, and God said,
you speak. And it felt right.
So I called the guru of the meeting. You know, every meeting has a guru that sits in the corner and takes everybody's inventory when we walk in. That's the meeting's guru. I called him. I said, Jim, we're going to have a speaker's meeting Tuesday night at St. Thomas. He said, how'd you figure that out? And I said, I prayed to God, and God told me. He said, I'll get back to you in a minute. He was at the Token Club there, the AA Club, and he called me back in about 10 minutes. He said, the strangest thing has happened. I don't know how it could have possibly happened, but it's happened. I said, what's that? And he said, well, there are five of us up here, and we all sat down and prayed and said, right now it looks like it's 5-1, the God of our understanding over the God of your understanding. I have known the absolute inspiration of isolated prayer, and I've known the complete delusion. I acknowledge all feelings, I pray about them, and I share them. Prayer and share, prayer and share, prayer and share, share the prayer. Share the prayer. My prayers today are simple. 11-step prayer to begin the day, 11-step prayer to close the day, the 10-step to enact the day, the 3rd and the 7th-step prayer to keep me between the curves. And it leads me to all the other steps, and it's really that simple. Don't drink, go to meetings, read the big book, honesty with myself, as much as possible using the group conscience. And finally, let me say one word about the big book. If you stop the drinking and don't deal with the thinking, you go back to the drinking. Alcohol is only a symptom. The bottle is only a symbol. That's written in our book. When I stopped drinking and then began to deal with the thinking through the big book, 8.5 years in this program, I came to know a program that dances and is alive. I sat with my God and I said, dear God, I'm not angry. I've known 8.5 years of a 4-step program. I've now known 2 years of an incredible 12-step program. Why did you leave my butt out there to hang? Why did you leave me? I love you, and I know you love me. What is the message? And I really did feel it. It said, Burns, you will lead by your knowledge. You will heal by your experience. You have an experience. Share it. If someone is clamoring and wondering why their program isn't working, tell them what happened in your life. If you want it all, use all 12 steps. First year of my recovery when I got home was crazy, as I shared with you. The night I got my token, I just sat there and cried. They said, how do you feel? And I said, I'm scared to death. Are you glad you're here? I don't know. You want a drink? No, I don't. Well, do you feel any better? Are you grateful? I don't know. Went home. Casey gave me a party. I went to bed. They had the party. Nothing seemed to fit. That first year's nuts. Then about 1.5 years in the program, I became little Mr. AA. It started clearing, and, you know, get up on time, eat your breakfast, get to the office, see your patients, call your sponsor, call your wife, eat your lunch, come home in the evenings, eat your supper, get to the meetings 30 minutes early, talk to the newcomer, set up the ashtray, set up the coffee, set up the chair, stay 30 minutes late, change numbers, get home in the evening, say your prayers, go to bed, boom, ba ba boom, 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 boom. We all know it, don't we? At the end of the 11th step, it says, as alcoholics, we are undisciplined. We allow God to discipline us in this way. Sandy Beat said, if you don't want to get drunk, don't drink and change everything else you're doing. That's changing a whole way of thinking, an entire psychic change. I used to sit with my sponsor in that first 5 years, and I'd say, Jim, what do you think are the psychological implications of my always being late in the morning? He'd say, why don't you get your ass up on time? And I used to think, yep, that's probably it. That's probably it. I was learning a whole new discipline. 5 years in the program, I was just like this, rigid as hell, perfect member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Pain was incredible. You could cut it with a knife. Old-timers would see me and smile and say, how are you, Burns? I'd say, I'm fine. This is a smile, you idiot. Can't you tell a smile? I was down in South Georgia visiting my dear friend Jim Law, who's an Episcopal priest and was my spiritual director when I came into the program. We don't talk about him much anymore, but it was very important in my life. And Casey and I were visiting him and his wife, and I came home, got on my knees at the Holiday Inn, and just sat there and I said, God, stop the pain. Casey put her hands on my shoulder and said, call your sponsor. My sponsor had a 2-step program. That's not a judgment, that's a report, because I want you to hear the coincidence of the message. The coincidence of the message. I called him. I said, Jim, I'm flying apart. And he said, Burns, you're the most compliant person I've ever known. I said, Jim, will I ever get it? And he said, yeah, you'll get it. When you get home, let's talk about it. So I started to hang the phone up. He said, Burns, let me ask you something.
"Do you believe if you work these steps perfectly today, it'll make you good?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "You're wrong." He said, "Do you believe if you get drunk today, it'll make you bad?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." He said, "You're wrong." I said, "I don't understand." He said, "Burns, you've been trying to buy something that isn't for sale. It's given for fun and for free. God loves you just the way you are. You can't earn it. You can't kick it away. If you're one of God's kids, He loves you just the way you are." I tried to be perfect for Mama. She couldn't handle it. I tried to be perfect for me, and I couldn't do it. I tried to be perfect for God, and He didn't need it. The story of the prodigal son that I listened to for years in that Baptist church became alive. Yes, it's the drunk who comes home. Yes, it's the brother who resents. But for me today, it's the story of the father who waits and is there for me when I come home without reservation. Just is there. Spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection became a way of life for me. For the next 3 years, God was preparing me to be able to love unconditionally. All my life, I've taken hostages. All my life, I've taken hostages, and everybody in AA takes hostages. My second greatest hostage was my first sponsor. I picked a sponsor who would make all my decisions. I took him all the information. I absolutely manipulated him into making my decisions, and he told me what to do, then I told my pigeons what to do. Most of my pigeons realized quicker than I did that he was full of manure after about 4 years. But I couldn't get away from him. They came to me and said, "Burns, why don't you leave him?" He gave me so much, and he did, and I love him deeply and worked this process to make my amends to him for some things. Not over what he did, but what I did. But I had to leave that sponsor and get another one. I had to change all of my meetings. I was ripped with the insecurity of doing that. My greatest hostage was and is my wife. Casey was in Al-Anon for 5 years and then switched to AA. I put Casey on my right hip, and everywhere I went, Casey went. I had a little noose around her neck, and I carried her everywhere I went. She came to me at 8.5 years in the program. I'd call her at 10 in the morning. I'd say, "Casey, I love you." She'd say, "Burns, I love you." I'd call her at 3 in the afternoon. I'd say, "Casey, I love you." She'd say, "I love you." And I'd call her at 10 in the morning. She might not be there. I'd call her at 3 in the afternoon. I'd say, "Casey, I love you. Where in the hell were you at 10 o'clock this morning?" She came to me 8.5 years in the program, and she said, "Burns, I want to go to my own meetings. I love you deeply, but I want to go into therapy. And I want to follow my own program. And I want to go back to school." And I said, "That's fine, honey." What I felt was, "And I'll not trust you, you bitch." She went back to school. My first solution to that was to get another woman. So I picked her out as one of my nurses. Went to Jack, my new sponsor, and I sat down with Jack, and I said, "Jack, I'm going to get rid of this woman, get me another one." He looked at me, he said, "You can do that. You can do that, but if you don't change your attitude, you'll run this one off just like you're running the other one off." And I just cried because I didn't know what he meant. When the student's ready, the teacher will arrive, and a little pigeon of mine with 7 months of sobriety walked up and gave me 8 tapes. They were Joe. He said, "Listen to these tapes and see if they're any good, because I want to listen to them." They were Joe and Charlie's tapes, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I listened to those tapes, I knew the program I didn't have. I knew this whole program, and I didn't have it. We made 12 copies of those tapes, and 12 of us got together, and we began to study those tapes. We stuck together through divorces, deaths, relapses. But we studied those tapes. I read it, took it into my head, took it into my heart, and today I live it. As I listened to those tapes and studied that book, what I came to know was the whole reason I'm even on the face of this earth. And God, I have always asked, why am I here? And it's right in the middle of the ninth step. I am here to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and my fellow man. That's it. That's it. And I said, "That's codependency." No, that's spirituality. In a vision for you, it said, "We cannot give away what we don't have, but if we ask each morning what we can do for the person who still suffers, and if our work with God is right." Well, what about unacceptable behavior? Read the promise that comes before the promises. There is the most magnificent promise of all at the end of the ninth step, right before the promises. It says, if we're sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble, as God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anybody. That's a statement of incredible simplicity and spirituality. It also says in the fifth chapter, we do not retaliate and we do not argue. And Jesus said, we turn the other cheek. This program has asked me to forgive the unforgivable, tolerate the intolerable, and love the unlovable. Thank God it's a program of progress rather than perfection. But the process is simple. It's called the Big Book and the 12 Steps. Casey did graduate from college, number one in her class. I was a part of the problem as much as I could be at that time, rather than I was a part of the solution rather than a part of the problem. She wanted a little red truck for her birthday, so we got her an Explorer, and the back on her license plate says "My Truck." Through the process of what I'd done, we went back into therapy for communication breakdown. We each carried a spiritual program in with us. Casey's attitude is superior to mine, or at least it's more tolerant than mine. It has been rocky. Not my recovery, but my ability to let go. We went back into therapy again about 2 months ago and decided that I would continue therapy and she would go out. Now we're going back in together. Big Book tells me that's okay. And even if it didn't, that's what my life is about today. I go to 5 meetings a week and I believe in this process of the 12 steps. I cannot live any other way. But I've had to peel some layers off I just have. It is getting better. It is not where it will be. The surrender for me in this area has been difficult. I've been advised to do everything from get a divorce to go to Al-Anon to shoot myself. The people who don't advise me but love me and help me work their experience, strength, and hope with the therapist has been the thing that is gradually turning me around. I will close by telling you 3 stories, and I appreciate your tolerance and patience. First story has to do with my daughter. 16 years ago, my daughter sat straddle at my chest. I was passed out drunk, and she was strung out on amphetamine, Darvon, and alcohol, and Valium. She tried to shoot me. The reason she didn't, it was an automatic shotgun, and she couldn't load it. She came in the program 11 years ago, and she got married 3 years ago, and guess who she asked to give her away? Daddy. June the 22nd was my 56th birthday. It was also Father's Day. Casey and I came home on a Sunday from a conference, and as we drove up in the driveway, there were balloons hanging from the mailbox, balloons above the garage, and balloons on the front door. And when I turned them around, it said, "Happy Father's Day, happy birthday to the world's greatest dad. Love, Sissy." These are messages of hope. It may not have happened in your life yet, but I promise you, if you stick around, you will get these benefits. I do not know what they will be. I do not know, but I'm sharing with you what has happened in my life. Second has to do with my son. When he was 17, he flunked out of high school his senior year because of alcoholism. He'd gone back to live with his mother. He lived with Casey and me for 3 years, and he went back to his mother, and his alcoholism became florid. He stole his mother's silverware. He stole his mother's car. She called the police, and they put him in jail in a little town outside of Louisville called Radcliffe. Sally left him in jail for 2 days, and I'd have gone and kissed her in the mouth because it was the greatest thing she could have done, except if I got that close to her, she'd shoot me. The woman still hates my guts, and she just does. But Burns came to talk to us, and for a year I'd been being prepared for what had to be done, spiritually and appropriately for my son. I was preparing myself to live with the consequences of doing what was in his best interest. He came and said, "Daddy, can I come live with you? Mama kicked me out." And I said, "No, you can't, Burns. I'll send you off to treatment for your alcoholism, and then we'll talk about it." He said, "I'm not an alcoholic." And I said, "No, that's not your call. I'm telling you, you are. You're going to treatment, or you don't live with me." And Casey, he said, "Screw you. I'm on the streets." And I said, "That's your choice. I love you." And I got to tell you, it was a year's preparation for that to happen. This is not a flamboyant, precipitous move. A tremendous amount of spiritual preparation for me to be able to deal with the consequences of that act. I knew where that boy was every minute of every day almost for 3 months. I knew God would lead me to do what I had to do if he got in trouble. He didn't know I knew where he was, but I was prepared, and God would help me do what I had to do. At the end of 3 months, he came back and said, "Daddy, please help me. Get me some help." Sent him off to treatment. Came back a year later. This was about 7 years ago. A year later, we were in a meeting, and there was a bunch of us sitting at that meeting. This woman raised her hand and said, "I have a problem. My boy went off to camp with 2 other boys. They caught them smoking dope. I know my son's smoking dope. What can I do to help him?" A bunch of us talked. My son raised his hand and said, "I don't know what can help your boy, but let me tell you what turned my life around. My sister was somebody I really loved, and she started taking dope, drinking alcohol, and she became somebody I loved but I didn't like. She came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and became a lady. Said, that wasn't what turned my life around. Said, my daddy would come home and hit my mother. He'd lie to us. He'd tell me and Sissy that he'd come pick us up, and he wouldn't. He said, then he quit drinking. He came home and told Mama he was sorry. He never lied to us anymore. If he said he'd be there, he'd show up. He gave Mama money that he owed her, and he didn't know that we knew it, but it had to do with my school. He said, when I was out there on those streets, I knew I wanted to grow up to be just like my daddy. Burns went to Academy of Commercial Art in Cincinnati. About a year ago, he started a business. We went out to Frisch's to talk about starting a business because I'd started a medical practice, had some business aspects, and he was asking me to share my experience. It's about a year ago. Now, it's been about 4 months ago. We got through talking. As we walked out the front door, I hugged him. I said, I really love you. And he said, I really love you too, Daddy. I said, let me know if you need me. And as I started to walk across the parking lot, he said, hey, Daddy. I said, what? He said, don't drink. Go to me and read the big book. Final story has to do with my father. Mama died in 78. I had 8 months of sobriety, and Casey and I'd go down every other weekend and hug Mama. I didn't have any real problems with Mama. She didn't have any problems with me. I made my amends. She hugged me and said, I knew about it. Burns Mac, I've always loved you. And she said, I'm sorry if I didn't act like I should have acted, but she died with dignity. And I see my mama every day. Those of you who know me know how much I love my mama and how grateful I am that it's clean. My daddy's the kind of man that was always there for me. When I broke my leg playing football, he was the first one to put me on a stretcher. I broke it playing basketball, first one on a stretcher. Broke it playing baseball, first one to put me on a stretcher. Daddy never said anything. He was just always there. I tried to make my amends to my daddy, and he looked at me and said, I don't want to talk about it. I kept trying to cram it down his throat, and you people told me I didn't have the right to pull my fat out of the fire by shoving something down his throat. Very powerful message. Daddy married my stepmother, a beautiful lady, about a year after Mama died. About 4 years later, Daddy started getting senile. It wasn't Alzheimer's. It looks like it, but it's arteriosclerotic cerebral vascular disease, hardening of the arteries. It looks like Alzheimer's. About 4 years ago, Daddy ceased to know who I was. He thought I was one of his brothers, my Uncle Buster, who incidentally died of alcoholism. I thought that was kind of interesting. He thought I was Uncle Buster. Then Daddy went into a nursing home, and I'd drive down to visit Daddy in the nursing home, and I ceased to call him Daddy because that confused him. He didn't even remember Mother. And each time I'd drive down to that nursing home, I'd say, God, take away the pain. Please stop my pain. This hurts so bad. Please. I'd go in and work with Daddy and talk to him, and I'd leave, and I'd just be ravaged, and I'd just cry all the way back to Louisville. This Saturday, I drove in, parked the car, and I said, Dear God, let me be for my daddy today what you want me to be. I walked in, Daddy was sitting in a wheelchair, and I said, Hal, what you need? And he said, Buster, would you shave me? And I said, yeah, and I shaved him. I said, are you hungry? And he said, yeah, I really am. I said, let's go ahead and get some lunch. And I rolled him into the dining room. He was too weak to feed himself, and I fed him. Daddy then was sitting in a chair, and my stepmother came in. This scene had been reenacted and enacted hundreds of times. Mama and I would sit and talk. Daddy never would say anything. He'd just sit here and watch us talk. Peggy, my stepmother, and I were sitting there talking, and Daddy just sitting in a chair watching, and we're talking. I was around. I said, Hal, would you like to go out on the sun porch? And he said, yeah. So I rolled him out there. He said, thanks, Buster. You're welcome. And Peggy and I started talking, and just talking, talking, talking. Daddy's sitting in the wheelchair. Finally, he raised up in the wheelchair, and he said, son, today you're just like the little boy your mama and I raised. I love you very much. Thank you for coming to see me. 10 seconds later, he didn't know who I was. He died in September. He never knew who I was again. The miracle is not that my daddy recognized me. The miracle is that I said, Dear God, let me be for my daddy what you want me to be. Thank you for giving me that. Alcoholics Anonymous is the language of the heart. We feel without touching. We hear without talking. We love by instinct. For the next few seconds, if you would, bow your head, hold the hand of the person next to you, or do whatever you want to do, but feel with me as I quit talking the language of the heart. because every talk I've ever given the same way. When I couldn't walk talking chew gum, I listened to tapes, and Father Martin was one of the tapes I listened to. And he says in that talk, better than I've ever been able to improve. You people are in my thoughts frequently. You will be in my heart, and you will be in my prayers always. I love you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you for asking me to talk. Thank you for listening to me. But most of all, thank rooms like this for delivering me the message that gave me my life. For those people that I've met again, it's good to see you. For those people I've met for the first time, welcome into my life. For those of you that I haven't met and may not, we will meet as we travel this, as we trudge this road of happy destiny. Thanks. Godspeed, and goodbye.